We are now talking about time and material that most Christians know virtually nothing about. And I hope this doesn't bore some of you. I think it's interesting. It tells us some interesting things that we didn't know. I always like to know about things that I haven't studied before. And so I'm going to dive into it. You don't have this handout yet. I just got the edited version myself about 5 minutes ago from Gordon. So you'll be getting this, I guess, 2-3 weeks from now, because I need to make this announcement, and I'll try to remember to do it again at the end of the class. I will be gone the next 2 weeks. I will not be here. There will not be class here the next 2 weeks. I will be in Greece. So going back to our lesson, this is a lesson on Christianity expanding into new languages and cultures. We already mentioned the fact that the Greek Septuagint of the Old Testament and the Koine Greek, and Koine, remember, is a Greek word which simply means the common, ordinary, regular Greek of the New Testament, dominated the Eastern Mediterranean for a millennium. In the West, the Latin Vulgate took its place. But there were many other areas where Christianity spread, and they had other languages. Translations of the Bible were made for them in their own languages. Toward the northeast, there were the Armenian and the Georgian languages, which on the African continent, it was the Ethiopic language. In between were language groups we know very little about, but which were also blessed by having the Bible in their own language, such as the Arabic, the Nubian, the Persian, the Sogdian, and Albanian. Okay, tell me how much you know about those languages. Yeah, well, that's what I thought. So you're no better off than I am, right? Okay. We know very little about the spread of Christianity in those areas, except for fragments of biblical translations and what we've discovered about their stories. So what we're going to see here is something which has been repeated to a considerable extent in more modern times. When people want to spread Christianity into a new area, into a new language, into a new culture, very often they have to not only write it down, they had to invent alphabets in these languages. They didn't have alphabets. There was nothing written in these languages. The very first written material in many of these languages was a portion of the scriptures. And that's still true. We know that the people still today are going in remote areas in Africa and South America and other parts and discovering people who you know, haven't been exposed to the outside world and inventing alphabets for them. And they do that in order to put the Bible in their language. Well, in Central and Western Europe, there were also translations made into Gothic, Slavonic, Anglo-Saxon, that sounds familiar, an Old High German and Low German. For several of those languages, an alphabet had to be invented, and the Christian Bible was the very first things written in that new language. Armenia was a much larger in those days, a much larger country in those days than it is today. Through some unusual circumstances, Gregory the Illuminator, we don't know very much about him, but apparently he was a Christian missionary of some sort, baptized King Tiridates III about AD 300. And Christianity being the national religion of Armenia at a time when Christians were still being severely persecuted in the West. So I want you to get this picture here. I'm doing it backwards for me so it'll be right for you. Way over there to the east was this huge country in the basically area of the Caucasus Mountains and the valleys there between the Caspian and the Black Sea, more or less. Here's this whole country, a large country, that officially adopted Christianity. It became the national religion, while in the West, the Christians are still being persecuted for their lives under Domitian, one of those guys, and Diocletian, was it? Anyway. Being terribly persecuted, while here on the other side, I mean, not that far away, Christianity was being adopted as a national religion. John.
In the news now, there's talk about Armenians being what was it, genocided by
yes.
the Turks?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the same country?
Yep. Same place. Only the area that's called Armenia today is quite a bit smaller than... It was much larger back in those days.
Yeah, but do they have the same language, more or less?
More or less.
Okay.
Yeah. See, and unless you are familiar with that culture and that language, we haven't even heard about these people or anything about their Bible going to them or any of that kind of stuff. A Christian missionary, and listen to this guy, talk about someone who did something. A Christian missionary by the name of Bishop Mesrob, and some spell his name Mesrop, devised an alphabet of 36 letters and translated or oversaw the translation of the Bible into the Armenian language around 410 A.D. It was probably originally translated from the Syriac, because, of course, the Syriac language is close to, was very close to them in that area and probably similar in many ways. But later, around A.D. 433, he went back and said, let's do a better job, 23 years later. He oversaw the revision of the Armenian Bible based on available Greek manuscripts. The Armenian Bible is unusual in that it includes several apocryphal works, including, have you ever heard of these books? The Death of Jeremiah, The Death of Ezekiel, The Hymn of Asenath, and of course that was Joseph's wife, and The Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And then in the New Testament, the Armenian Bible includes the Epistle of the Corinthians to Paul, not Paul to the Corinthians, but the Corinthians to Paul, and 3 Corinthians. Okay, are you all familiar with those books?
No, but they are interesting.
Gordon.
Well, it's interesting. In Corinthians, doesn't Paul say, you asked about...
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, it raises the door for there to have been a
yes.
letter from the Corinthians to Paul.
Yes, exactly. And he says also, you know, I previously wrote a letter to you. So there was correspondence that we don't have. There's no question about that. John.
Well, how could we get a peek at those?
Well, they're available. What we have of them, many of them are incomplete. We don't have necessarily the whole thing.
You mean in English?
Well, they've been translated in English, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. We could have a riotous time looking at all these ancient books. I tell you, yeah. Furthermore, in the Armenian Bible, each book of the Old Testament has a preface containing an introduction and a summary of its contents. Would you like to know what they thought of each of the books of the Old Testament back in those days? The Armenian translation, being in a language close to the Greek, is beautifully done and very accurately reflects the original Greek. So, yes, apparently it was a pretty good translation. Also in the Caucasus region was the country of Georgia. Christianity reached Georgia through the efforts of a slave woman named Nina. Now, here's two countries side by side. One country gets Christianity by a missionary arriving and baptizing the king, And the religion becomes a national religion, and the country right next door gets Christianity from a slave woman. Not only a slave, but a woman. Ladies, stand up and cheer. How do you suppose that happened? I wish I knew more. We don't know much about these stories. We just, you know, there are little pieces of it hinted by other people who write about it. And here's this. I mean, there's lots of fascinating stories we're going to learn when we get to the Better Kingdom. That will be very, very interesting. There is some evidence that she may have been a convert from Judaism. So here's a lady who was probably at first a Jew, then became a Christian, then was captured probably and sold as a slave to Georgia and ends up bringing Christianity to the whole country. I mean, this is a little bit like the slave girl in Naaman, right? Bishop Mesrob also devised a new alphabet for the Georgians, into which the Bible was translated around AD 450. So she wasn't the only one who did something there. Again, a new alphabet is invented, put it up here, by the guy who invented an alphabet for the Armenians, and the Bible was translated. To the people from Western Europe, European civilizations rather, the country of Ethiopia was usually thought of as being the end of the world. Did you want to say something?
Well, I was thinking of the woman at the well.
Yeah.
She had quite an influence in her country, but of course she had
backups and stuff like that. So this slave lady could have gotten the ball rolling, and the country next door came in and
helped.
But that means that both those women were very Holy Spirit filled and very influential.
Yeah.
Because the woman at the well had no better reputation than this slave woman.
Yeah. True. Very true. Okay. During the 4th century, two missionaries, known as Frumentius and Edesius from Tyre, were sent to Ethiopia as prisoners. Now, here's some other people who got a great start. They were sent there as prisoners. Later, they became missionaries. Sometime in the 5th or 6th century, which would be 100 years later, the Bible was translated into the ancient Ethiopian language of Ge'ez, probably from the Greek. There's pretty good evidence, and I hope you're beginning to see why one of the ways in which we get an idea about, okay, a certain language was used when translating the Bible into this particular language is they included some of these books. And if the Armenians have all these extra books, and now you find another language over here who has some of those extra books, then what do you say? It was probably translated from the Armenian, right? You just get an idea of how scholars go about trying to make those kinds of decisions. There's pretty good evidence that Christianity became a state religion in Ethiopia as early as the 5th century. Again, another nation where Christianity became the national religion. The earliest translations into Ethiopic were probably done under the auspices of the newly converted king. The Ethiopic Bible omitted Ezra and Nehemiah as well as Maccabees, but it did include the Book of Enoch and the third Book of Baruch, both of which have hardly been preserved in other languages. So, I mean, where did those books come from? How did they get down there? Why were they preserved there? I mean, there's all sorts of questions I would like to know answers to, but basically we don't know. The Book of Enoch, if any of you ever read it, is a very interesting book, by the way. It's probably quoted in the Book of Jude. But here it is down, and the copies that we have available to us, the most complete copies we have of this Book of Enoch are in Ethiopian, the Ethiopian language. Christianity continued to grow in Egypt as well. The fact that the Nile River Valley had desert on both sides provided an easy hiding place for Christians to escape from Roman persecution. Two important names remain from that time, Antony and Pachom. These two began to organize ascetic communities, and we'll talk more about those later, ascetic communities which were probably the earliest stages of the monastic movement. So here are some people who not only were, you know, spreading Christianity, but starting specialized Christian communities in these countries where Christianity is growing up. Now, what this should teach us is something very interesting. This shows that Christianity has, or at least in the early stages, had a tremendous motivating power. I mean, it's even true today. Why do people go off to the far corners of the world just to carry the gospel to other people that they've never seen, heard, know anything about? See? So clearly, religion and Christianity in particular, we're talking about here, seems to have had real motivating power. It motivated prisoners, it motivated slaves, it motivated missionaries to go to kings. I mean, all those things. Okay, we know that Christianity made inroads into Arabia during apostolic times. Arabian people were present at Pentecost. You know, remember that story? Let's look at that real quick. You remember the story about the disciples at Pentecost and speaking in, you know, supposedly all these languages. And it says, verse the end of verse 7, these people who are talking like this are Galileans. How is it then that all of us hear them speaking in our own native languages? We are from Parthia, Media, and Elam, from Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, from Pontus, and Asia, from Phrygia and Pamphylia, from Egypt, and the regions of Libya near Cyrene. Some of us are from Rome, both Jews and Gentiles, converted to Judaism, and some of us are from Crete and Arabia. And your Arab friends, some of us have some Arab friends, are very quick to point out that they had representatives there at Pentecost. Yet all of us hear them speaking in our own language about the great things that God has done. And there's another reference to Arabia that we know about, and that's in Galatians 2, verse 17, I believe it is. Maybe it's 1:17. Hold on here. Okay. But you remember the story of Paul and how he was converted in Damascus. And he says in verse 16, I did not go to anyone for advice, nor did I go to Jerusalem to see whether those who were apostles before me. Instead, I went at once to Arabia, and then I returned to Damascus. Why did Paul go to Arabia? Any idea? We don't know. Did he know that, was he just escaping like the people down in Egypt because it was a desert place and he figured nobody would chase him there? Or was it possible that there were already known Christian communities somewhere out in Arabia? We just don't know. John.
Who were the other 11 apostles with Peter? Just now where you were telling about.
You mean James, John, all the other disciples?
It said Peter stood up with the other 11 apostles. Yeah. I thought there would be who were they?
The disciples. All the disciples. Judas has been replaced by Matthias.
Oh, Matthias. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, and what we learn here is that in Arabic, some of the same things happened as it happened earlier in Latin. There is some evidence that there were Arabic translations of the Bible as early as the 3rd century. Excuse me. There seem to have been a wide number of different translations of portions of the Scripture into Arabic. In Arabic, a translation from the Coptic still exists. There are other Arabic manuscripts apparently translated from the Samaritan Pentateuch. So people were pulling things in from all over the place and translating them into Arabic. Later, a translation was made from the original Hebrew by Saadia the Gaon, a Jew born in Upper Egypt around AD 892 and who moved to Babylon and became the most famous Jew of his time. And now he's translating into Arabic. But interestingly enough, while the Pentateuch was translated from the Hebrew, and as was the book of Joshua, many other portions of the Old Testament were translated from Aramaic Peshitta. Some portions from, including Psalms, Proverbs, and some of the prophets were translated from the Greek Septuagint. So, I mean, you wonder how all these things, I mean, it's amazing that the way God has preserved this Bible that we have today. I mean, the Latin Vulgate is a whole patchwork. Some came from here, some came from there, some came from something else, and there it is in Latin. Okay, all together. Some of it's not translated quite a bit of it was not translated by Jerome. He didn't translate portions of it. Some he supervised, some he didn't supervise. Well, here's the same story going on in Arabic. Pieces from here and there and there. So what's happening? Why do you think this is happening like this? Stop and think about it for a second. Why do you think it's all happening like this? Anybody have an idea? Joanne?
I'll just get it started. Everybody wanted to read this book, and that's the only way it could be done. How else could it be done? But are these okay translations? And were there other reasons why it was being done this way?
I think that you basically hit on the point. I think that people said, we want to read the Bible. We want to know everything we can about the Old Testament and the New Testament. And somebody said, okay, well, let's put it into the local language. Well, here's a piece that's in Hebrew. Here's a piece that's in something else. Here's a piece in something else. They were grabbing everything they could get their hands on and try to translate it into their language.
Could it be like we're grabbing everything we can now on the Internet and we're just learning how to be discriminatory and know that there's good and bad out there?
Okay. We got Dennis up there. I think he was next, and then Gordon.
At this time, what was the physical manuscript like?
There were still some scrolls, but the common form of manuscripts at this point in time were beginning to be codices or codexes. And those were papyrus books that were either sewed or glued together on one side, more or less like our books now, but made, you know, the pages were from the strips of papyrus that had been sliced and then put together and dried. Yeah. Gordon.
Were the translations at that time somewhat akin to, well, a certain person decides, well, I'll translate the good news into some language in Africa or wherever, mm-hmm. and someone else decides, well, I'll translate the message mm-hmm. into here. That, you know, they're coming from different sources, something that they think that's what they like, that's what they have available.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of something they liked and what they had available, yeah. That's probably what happened. Missionaries also reached Nubia. Who knows where Nubia is? I'll give you a clue there. Most of it's in present-day Sudan. Sometime in the 3rd century, there are small fragments of a Nubian Bible translated between the 8th and 10th century. So what we see in these countries is that Christianity gets started in each country, and then after a while, someone says, okay, we've got to have a Bible in this language, and there it is, and there are pieces, little pieces of it still left. Christianity moved further east into Persia by the 3rd or 4th century. Many Persians could probably read the Syriac, which, of course, remember the Syriac had a huge big area over there close to Persia. But a true Persian translation of the scriptures was soon made. Only a few fragments remain. Further east, along the Silk Road into East Turkestan and Central Asia, the spread of Christianity resulted in a Bible translated into the lingua franca of that day, or that area, called Sogdian. How many of you are fluent in Sogdian? I never even heard of it before. But apparently that was the language that the traders used going east and west on the Silk Route. And so the Bible has to be in that language, right? Incredible as it may seem, there's a tradition suggesting that Bishop Mesrob also created an alphabet for the Albanians, which are not the Albania that we have now. I don't know whether the current Albanians came from over there, but these original Albanians were in what is presently called Azerbaijan. Later, Bishop Jeremiah translated the Bible into that language. Unfortunately, we have not yet found any traces of the actual biblical text. So in some cases, we can see that we have a little bit of the text, but we don't know the story behind it or the tradition behind it. In some cases, we have the tradition, but we don't have the text. So we've got both ways going here. Gordon.
There was some tradition that Thomas went all the way to India, even during his day.
Yep.
Did you find anything about translations in India?
Haven't gotten to that material yet, but yes. Absolutely. There are people in India who swear that the gospel was taken to their areas, and there's definitely Christian areas over there in his day. Yeah. Joanne.
From what I'm seeing, and I'm not a historian by any means, and this is a wild thought, it seems like the Middle East was the bedrock of Christianity mm-hmm. and attacked heavily then by Satan, because it definitely is not the bedrock anymore.
No.
Could it be that God has his gems buried in their deserts to one day again awaken them as these archaeologists finally get to dig and discover?
Well, there's new things being discovered all the time. Who knows what's out there in those desert sands? I mean, there could be another Dead Sea Scrolls kind of discovery at some point. I mean, it's possible. Very possible. Absolutely. Okay. Well, turning now to Central and Western Europe, in the areas between the Danube and the Black Sea, two large tribes were dominant. These tribes were influenced by Arianism, which I didn't spell correctly, but I have to fix that. What's Arianism? Okay, all you biblical scholars. What's Arianism? Dennis is going to help me.
Well, I believe it's the belief or the philosophy, the understanding that Jesus did not exist from time beginning, but was somehow created or born, came into existence, and then deified.
Yes. In other words, Jesus is not fully, quite fully God like the other members of the Godhead. Yeah, that's Arianism. And Arianism was very common in among this particular group of people known as these two large tribes were known as the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. And who are they? Why are they important? Have we heard those names before?
Yeah. They invaded Rome.
Yes.
Eventually, about, what was it, 538?
In fact, without,
plus or minus,
without going into a lot of detail, it was, I believe, the Visigoths that were encouraged by the emperor over in Constantinople to go back because he thought things were getting out of hand in Rome. He sent them over there to keep these people in line. They went over there, and remember the story I told you about this. Here, something like 100,000 of these Visigoths attacked Rome. And they figured there were no more than 5,000 men in the city of Rome at this point in time, but they couldn't get in because the walls were pretty solid and pretty well protected. So they sat there for a while. They got tired of waiting, and they decided, okay, we'll hasten things up a little bit. And if any of you visited Rome, you know there's those old Roman aqueducts that brought water into the city of Rome. So they said, we'll just bust up their water supply, and they'll have to come out because they'll run out of water. What they didn't calculate for is that when they busted up the aqueducts, they didn't make any provision for where the water was going to go. Pretty soon, water was flooding through all the fields. There was a huge growth of mosquitoes, and bang, pretty soon all the Visigoths were dying off of malaria. And the Pope, in 538 BC, does that date sound vaguely familiar? The Pope, or the leader of the Christian Church in Rome at that point in time, when he saw that things were turning in his favor, made a surprise attack out of the city of Rome with about 5,000 men and wiped out this 100,000 strong Visigoth army. And thus, the Pope became not only the spiritual head of Rome, but the military and factual political head of Rome. And thus, we count that date as being the date when the civil government of Rome passed into the hands of the religious authorities, and we date from 538 to 1798. Well, here's these Visigoths being mentioned in our story here. Anyone have any questions about, that's a very brief account of the story. Okay. Well, there were these two tribes, and they came originally from this area up between the Danube and the Black Sea, and they had migrated, a whole group of them had migrated down there and caused this disturbance. An important missionary by the name of Ulfilas, and that's his name in Latin, or Wulfila if you use Gothic or German, went there between the years AD 311 and 383. So you see, missionaries, even at a time when in Rome they were still having huge battles over whether Christianity would even exist, missionaries were quietly invading all these surrounding nations and turning them into Christians. In order to produce a Bible in their language, he had to invent a Gothic alphabet. So here's another language in which the alphabet was invented for the purpose of writing a Bible. Let's see, okay. He used characters from the Greek and Latin as well as other characters. Interestingly enough, he translated the entire Bible but left out the Book of Kings, apparently because he thought it was too violent. Now, there's an interesting reason for choosing which books you want in the Bible. We've already talked about the guy who left out Ezra and Nehemiah and the Maccabees, maybe for the same reason, I don't know. Further north and east, the Slavic peoples were also reached by two brothers, Methodius and Cyril. They were a Greek nobility from Macedonia. After being educated in Constantinople, they moved to Moravia in what is now the Czech Republic. Before his death in AD 869, Cyril invented an alphabet known as Glagolitic. After his death, his brother Methodius oversaw the translation of the entire Bible in what is now known as Old Church Slavonic. He chose to leave out the books of Maccabees, apparently because he thought they were too violent. So you see how these kinds of ideas keep spreading. Christianity also reached Great Britain. There are traces of Christianity there as early as the 4th century. Later, considerable missionary work was done there by Celtic and Roman missionaries, and we haven't talked about where the Celtic missionaries came from. Anybody know where the Celtic missionaries came from? And how did... Celtic? Okay, and how did they get Christianity? I don't know.
I think
they say St. Patrick. Don't know. St. Patrick? Maybe so. I haven't had a chance to research that one yet. We have only traces of an Anglo-Saxon translation done somewhere between the 7th and 8th centuries. It was probably translated from the Latin Vulgate. In Western Europe, Christianity was carried to the Franks along the lower Rhine River, as evidenced by the baptism of King Clovis I in AD 496. Only very small fragments of the ancient German translation made at that time are extant. And this is just, and I may want to add some more to this handout, but this is just a taste, basically, of how we can see what's going on here. Christianity is moving to new countries. People are hearing about it. They're getting excited about it. People are being baptized. They want to hear the Christian message in their own language. Alphabets are being invented so the Bible can be translated. Joanne?
I think this would have to be God giving people the gift of tongues. Can you imagine inventing the letters, putting the people's sounds to the letters, then forming words and the whole Bible just from nothing?
Yeah.
To me, that has to be God-inspired.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of talent is that called when you are a inventor of language, writer down of new letters and...
Well, we have people still doing it today. The Wycliffe Bible translators, that's what they do.
That's what they do?
Yeah. They go to an area and they live with the people until they can learn the language. And once they've learned the language, they've learned certain ways to try to, you know, develop alphabets and so forth. They try to keep it as simple as possible.
When they develop alphabets today, is the alphabet based on English letters or do they actually invent letters?
Well, they probably use English letters as far as possible because that's probably where they came from. Yeah.
I mean, these people are inventing letters also.
They're inventing all kinds of letters. Yeah.
To me, that's a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah, you read about the one alphabet that had 36 letters in it. I mean, where did the other 10 come from? Of course, Hebrew only has 22. So, and Greek has, what, 24? So... You know, we're going up the ladder. Any other comments about that? We're going to move over to something else, which is very interesting that I want to talk about.